Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me tonight as tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. By now well-known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights, Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas.
We hear of a changing landscape in the Supreme Court. Now and again, we hear of decisions that are game changers or that change the status quo without a lot of background. Do these cases come out of left field?
I think with our current Supreme Court, I don't know if I'd say left field, but tonight in what was a regular feature of Your Legal Rights, we look ahead. We're hoping to restore starting tonight. We look ahead to prominent cases now working their way along the Supreme Court's docket. What is really being considered right now? And what's the court likely to do?
Our guests tonight are esteemed appellate lawyers engaged in the legal landscape of the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. Who better to look down the barrel of the Supreme Court to see what's coming next?
As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and to answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. That is if you're in the Bay Area. If you're outside of the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free. We'll pay the freight, 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice. We don't have all the salient facts of your case. We're happy to share the legal principles to help you in your decision-making. And you can contact us with any question about the Supreme Court of our upcoming cases there. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation.
To help us sort out just what is going on out there, present you with our two esteemed panelists. First, Ben Foyer is the chairman of the California Appellate Law Group, a boutique law firm specializing in appeals with offices in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. Ben has been called one of the top appellate litigators in California by a national news network and named one of the top 40 lawyers in California under 40 by the Daily Journal. Among other honors, he clerked on the Ninth Circuit, and he frequently writes on constitutional and appellate matters for publications like the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the National Law Journal.
A partner at King & Spalding at the firm's Appellate, Constitutional, and Administrative Law Group, Ann Voights has worked on cases before the United States Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court, and federal and state appellate and trial courts, and argued nearly 60 cases in federal and state appellate courts. Ann previously served as a Supreme Court clerk, a Ninth Circuit clerk, and a federal prosecutor with over a decade of public service. Ms. Voights is certified as a specialist in appellate law by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. To one and all of you, to each of you, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
I second that. Thanks very much for having us.
The one question that's on everybody's minds these days: will the Supreme Court ultimately decide this election?
No.
I think very unlikely, and certainly if there's any way they can avoid doing it, they will avoid getting involved at all.
I agree with that. And I may be saying that from the perspective of somebody who may have a little bit of PTSD because I clerked on the court during the year of Bush v. Gore. But, you know, I think the court is leery of losing its sort of respect or its capital by taking on cases that are unlikely to make any real difference to the ultimate result of the election and that will only make the court look like a political institution.
And as I recall, Chief Justice Roberts has said on multiple occasions that there's no such thing as Republican or Democratic justices. Do you think that is really what's driving this?
I think John Roberts, if he has one singular goal at this point during his time as Chief Justice in the Roberts Court, it is to do his darndest to keep the court from being perceived as a political institution, or at least a completely political institution, especially during this incredibly divisive time that we find ourselves in. He is really actively trying to find ways to keep the court out of the political fray and maintain its sort of ability to float above the politics of the day to decide important issues from the Constitution and from the laws without the perception that they're just doing one party or the other party's political bidding. And if they can stay out of the election completely, if the lower courts let them stay out of the election completely by not making any terrible decisions, and so far they haven't, it seems, the court is going to try to let the political branches decide this election as much as they can.
Well, let me follow up on, I just heard everyone else did the same time, that Anne, you said you clerked for the Supreme Court during the time of Bush versus Gore, and I believe you clerked for Justice Stevens, who was in the dissent on that. What makes the court so different, and is it so different now than when that decision came down, where everyone viewed it as very much the court getting involved in a political, and some people thought inappropriately so, deciding a political issue?
Well, I think it's not necessarily just the court, but also the cases that are coming up and the situation in which the country finds itself, right? This is not a case where it's a matter of a single state or a couple hundred votes that make a difference. And so here, in order to change the results of the election, you would have to get significant relief in a number of different states. And they just haven't come up with a vehicle for that. I think Mark Elias has a running toll of how many cases he's won for Biden as opposed to the ones that he's lost. I think he's somewhere like 48-2 at this point, or maybe 48-1, depending on how you count.
I think 51 now as of today, I saw that Trump has lost.
Is there any sense that the court is disinclined to get engaged in these battles because of Bush versus Gore, because it was seen after that as a political entity? Do you think that has an impact?
Alternatively stated, is it simply a case of once burned, twice shy?
So it might be. I mean, it's interesting. You have a couple of justices on the court who actually worked as lawyers on one side or the other of the Bush v. Gore case. But I think it's also, like I said, a function of the claims that are being raised and how they're being raised, which are pretty different from what you saw in Bush v. Gore.
Yeah, and Bush. I was just going to say Bush v. Gore. I mean, it was, you know, we were talking about, I think there was a difference of 570 votes or something, you know, between Bush and Gore in Florida at the time the recounts were stopped. And, you know, today across four or five states that would need to have the election undone if the Supreme Court were to undo the election, you're talking about tens, if not hundreds of thousands of votes that would need to be tossed out. It's not going to happen. The political purpose, I think quite frankly that Trump and his attorneys know this. They hope maybe the Supreme Court will get involved, but I think that their real legal strategy here is not as much about getting the Supreme Court to issue a decision like Bush versus Gore, but to keep the final certification of the electoral votes open. The statute that locks in the state's electoral votes at this point in December has a little opening for when there's a challenge, a legal challenge that's still proceeding against the certification. And I think that the president's team is attempting to use that as a wedge so that when Congress has to come back and approve the electoral votes, which in American history has always been a kind of pro forma rubber stamp, of course, we're a democracy. Trump and his team is trying and hoping that Congress will reject the electoral count and ultimately essentially appoint him as president for another term.
And
right,
ultimately,
it really feels like they're playing,
they're
playing to multiple courts. And the Supreme Court is maybe the least important of those. And the court of public opinion and of other politicians is significantly more important.
And I would be remiss if I didn't add that our last show of this year on December 30 will be a look at exactly that. The timing where this would all come into play is going to be coming up in early January. We'll be taking a look, an in-depth look at what my guest refers to as Trump's last stand on December 30. Let me turn it to Deborah from Oakland. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I have, a constitutional question. What would happen if Biden were to die before he was inaugurated?
Perish the thought.
Perish the thought, but would it go to the Supreme Court or would it go to Kamala, or would it go to Trump? I mean, what would happen?
So the answer is that the electors are chosen to vote by the states. And many states now have restrictions requiring electors to vote for the candidate that won the state's popular votes. And in fact, many make it a crime for an elector not to do so. If Biden were chosen as president and Kamala Harris were chosen as vice president by the electors, then Kamala would immediately ascend to the presidency under the Presidential Succession Act, because the vice president becomes the president in that case. However, it would, of course, be an unprecedented situation there, given everything else that's kind of going on with the Electoral College. You know, the all bets in a certain way might be off, especially if that happened before the point in time at which the Congress had to approve the Electoral College's selections.
Yeah, that was my question.
But what would happen, and I'll throw this back to you, Ben and Ann, what would happen when, as Deborah described, you have an incident where a president-elect or presumed president-elect dies not only before taking office, but before the vote of the Electoral College? So somewhere between the election and the time the Electoral College meets, something happens.
The states have different rules on this. It's actually set by the states. Many states have rules simply saying the electors are required by law to vote for the person who won the popular vote, and they don't take into account this possible risk. Other states allow, in such a situation, would allow the electors to be directed by the political party that appointed them, and generally they're chosen by political parties. Conceivably, some states may allow the electors to choose freely. All of the electors chosen by the parties, almost to a person, are very strong partisans. So these are people who are not going to vote for Donald Trump, or at least the vast majority of them would never vote for Donald Trump or someone who isn't a Democrat. Conceivably, the electors could get together and choose Kamala Harris. One way or another, I suspect that Kamala Harris would become the president of the United States.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
You know, there's one case I'd like to bring up in particular out of the election litigation I think is interesting, which was Texas's lawsuit that it brought directly in the Supreme Court under original jurisdiction, challenging other states and that went for Biden. And it's really interesting to me because it raises a question about whether the court has to take it. So original jurisdiction just means that the case goes directly to the Supreme Court. There's no proceedings in the district court, no decision by an appellate court. The Supreme Court has to face it. Normally it's for disputes between states over things like water rights. You know, is one state taking too much from a particular river? So to use it this way, I think, is particularly unprecedented. And to use it to try and overturn other states' electoral processes is, again, I think, something that I don't recall ever having seen before. And Ben, I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, I'm going to put it straight out there. This is a garbage lawsuit by the Attorney General of Texas, a man named Ken Paxton, who is under significant investigations for corruption at the moment, both federal and state investigations. He had his entire top staff resign on him about a month ago because they thought he was too corrupt. And so, you know, this lawsuit has, I think, no merit whatsoever. I mean, if I were a member of one of these swing states, even a Republican, I'd be tremendously offended. And he's doing it to distract from his own domestic politics. Many of these lawsuits, certainly the ones by the Trump administration, the Trump campaign that we talked about at the beginning of the program, and the ones that you see coming up from various different groups, are about the politics of filing these lawsuits. They're not about the litigation value of these lawsuits or really necessarily thinking they're going to win. They got close in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin, there was which did not meet the certification deadline, I should point out. But in Wisconsin, there was a 4-3 vote of their Supreme Court about whether to kind of send the whole thing back for a recount. And one of the Republicans joined with the liberals on that court, basically to save democracy in Wisconsin. And, you know, I think that that's really and I suspect that that individual may have political problems when he goes for re-election. But that's what's going on here. These are lawsuits about the politics of this and not really the litigation of this. And those lawyers, you know, there are a lot of efforts to potentially file complaints about some of these lawyers in state bar associations, because lawyers aren't supposed to do that. Lawyers are only supposed to file lawsuits that have real merit, and they're not supposed to use the courts as a political platform. We'll see if anything comes up, you know, from that.
Yeah, going to your point about this being largely political, today I think it was Missouri and 16 other states that had gone for Trump in the election filed an amicus brief in the suit brought by Texas. And they didn't really say how you should come out. They basically just say, look, this case is important, which I think was a way of sort of making a political point, but not a legal one.
Anything they could do to extend this out so that Trump can argue the election isn't settled, it's open, Congress should send it my way, there was fraud, even though there isn't even a scintilla of a basis for fraud, as Trump's own attorney general has said, at least not fraud of any scale that would affect the election. This is all about keeping the election from appearing final so Trump can go to his allies, the Republicans, in the Senate, especially where they have a majority, and say, hey, you should just give me this election.
And again, we'll revisit this issue on December 30, where we will talk about Trump's last stand, where all this plays out the following week. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're looking at the cases that are upcoming in the Supreme Court, with appellate lawyers extraordinaire Ann Voigt, Ben Foyer. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to the Supreme Court. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation.
Before we go on to the specific cases before the court, let me ask you both this. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was replaced by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who went from a very liberal justice to one who's very conservative. How is this going to impact the court? And let me throw something else in there, a question. Is it Chief Justice John Roberts was trying to lead it, and some would say leading it in a direction that a lot of people weren't anticipating. Is that going to switch how he votes? Otherwise, it might make him somewhat, I don't want to say irrelevant, that sounds disrespectful, but you know what, I'll stick with that word.
Sure. Why don't I jump in on the Chief Justice Roberts question first, if you don't mind, because I think that's a really interesting one. I think you saw, you know, in the first Affordable Care Act case, a switch that really was maybe less about his belief on the merits and more about his concern about how the court would be perceived. And so I think he may be one of the swing votes, but where those justices are going to swing is going to be considerably further to the right than it's been previously. So, you know, the middle ground is narrower and narrower, and there's been sort of a Overton window shift towards the right as we've moved along.
Yeah, you know, your question about what the replacement of Ruth Bader Ginsburg with Amy Coney Barrett will mean for the court sort of almost answers its own questions. It's going to be a very significant change. There's no doubt about that. There were so many cases that were 5-4 one way or another, and now the conservatives have a 6-3 majority on the court, and many of those are pretty conservative folks. Amy Coney Barrett is not a swing justice. The reality is that you're right. John Roberts was when it was a 5-4 court, trying to, you know, one could say maximize his own influence. You could also say steer a course for the court that is not tremendously political, or at least was somewhere in the middle on many of the political issues, by becoming a swing vote. He wasn't nearly as liberal as Justice Kennedy, the previous swing vote, was. There were still situations where he went, you know, and agreed with the liberals on important issues. For example, many of the pandemic issues he was agreeing with the liberal justices on. And now his vote matters much less, because even if he agrees with the liberals, there are still only 4 votes, him and the 3 liberals, to take that position. So he still loses. So for him, there's very little kind of political reason. And when I say political reason, I mean political within the court, to give up perhaps some of his credibility as a conservative by taking more liberal positions and joining with the liberals, because it won't make a difference. There's really no point for him to take on that risk. So I think you will probably see him doing things where, as Anne says, trying to push the court into a little bit of a narrower way of thinking than it maybe previously would have gone or might have gone. Even if beforehand he would have gone in direction A, and you know the conservatives want to go in direction B, he might try to go through something in the middle. And I think we saw that recently, and that can lead us into our discussions a little bit about some of the specific cases. I think we saw that recently in one of what I would describe as one of the 3 or 4 Trump cases, the cases that are really specific to Donald Trump, and that will probably may go away, assuming Donald Trump is no longer president after January 20th. And the case that I have in mind is a case called Trump against New York. And this is a case involving the census. Obviously, the United States, according to the Constitution, engages in a census count every 10 years, where the government is supposed to do its very best to get an accurate count of the number of people who live in the United States. The government also collects some other information about them, but it's basically designed to just get some numbers. Who is here? How many people are here, and where are they located? And as a result of the census, a lot of different money is allocated. The number of seats in Congress and in the House of Representatives are allocated. So the census is very important. And the Trump administration has taken the position, unsurprisingly, that it's going to try to do something different from what every other previous administration has done with the census. And in this case, they are going to exclude undocumented immigrants, so-called illegal aliens, people who are in the United States. And remember, the census is designed to count people who are here. People who are here, no question about that, but they weren't here legally. And there are millions of people, as we know, who are in that situation. So the Trump administration has sought to exclude the counting of these individuals from the census. Oral arguments took place on this case a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that struck me about the oral arguments is that John Roberts seemed to be taking the position that, you know, maybe the court doesn't need to decide this case. Maybe the case has come around a little bit too early, because the Trump administration, and this is all assuming the Trump remains in power and this policy continues, but even if it does, you know, maybe they'll put in this policy, but the way they actually put it in won't really have a big impact. And that, to me, sounded like Roberts trying to push the court in a neutral direction, even if he himself might actually think, you know what, you can't do this. And in fact, some of the more conservative justices on the Supreme Court, including a newly appointed Justice Amy Coney Barrett, seemed pretty skeptical from their questioning that you can really do this, since the census was designed to count actual people. But that even if Roberts kind of thought you couldn't do this, he might have been worried that, you know, his more conservative colleagues would go along with it. So he was trying to push the court into a direction of, hey, maybe we can put off deciding this. Maybe we won't have to decide it in the end. And that to me was a sign of kind of what we were talking about. You know, how is Roberts going to react now that he is no longer the swing vote?
And interestingly, you know, you also saw some hesitation on the part of the more conservative justices as well at argument about trying to jump in and decide this. So you had Justice Barrett asking whether it should be better for the justices to wait and see what the president actually did with the data, you know, what categories of would actually end up being excluded.
Yeah.
So I think you saw some distaste for the idea of trying to resolve this if they could possibly push it down the road.
Yeah, and this is, I think, probably one of the lessons that Trump will learn or may learn or may be forced to learn about the difference between the conservative judicial movement and the conservative political movement, because they are different in very important ways. For Trump, Trump is a purely transactional thinker. He thinks if he does something for you, you'll do something for him. That's why he's so upset the governor of Georgia isn't overturning their law, because their election, because he had supported the governor of Georgia. And why yesterday he tweeted an angry picture of Amy Coney Barrett, the justice he just put through to the Supreme Court, with laser beams coming out of her eyes, suggesting she was a dupe because she had joined with the other justices to unanimously refuse to consider one of his many challenges, this one challenging the election results in Pennsylvania. So Trump can't understand how could somebody he appointed or nominated to the court, how could that person not find in a way that would benefit him, right? That's just payback. But the conservative judicial movement is very different from the conservative political movement. Yes, they are mostly are Republicans, or all, I suppose, are Republicans. Some are never Trump Republicans. But their focus is, for the most part, on what the Constitution says, what the laws said, what the precedent said. And their view is that judges should act correctly within their sphere and not go outside of their sphere and start becoming what they consider to be activist judges. That's what they're mostly concerned about. And that is often very different from what the political establishment is concerned about, especially in the Trump era.
And Ben, if you don't mind if I jump in for a second.
Yeah, please.
I think one of the other interesting things about the census case was that it highlighted when the question came about what checks would actually exist, what institutional checks would exist on the Trump administration, the federal checks seemed to sort of fall away, right? But the states sort of stepped up and, as in this case, sued to challenge policies that they thought exceeded either constitutional or statutory bounds. And I think seeing how aggressive the states were was an interesting sort of flip. You normally think about the conservative legal movement prioritizing states and state autonomy. And now you had, under the Trump administration, more liberal states using arguments that you normally wouldn't have seen them deploy to try and invalidate or postpone or stay policies that they didn't agree with.
So we have just a very brief time. I did get a caller that instead of wanting to speak on the air, he sent me some questions. The first is calls for a pretty brief answer. That is, if President Trump resigns and then President Pence pardons him, do all the court cases filed for Donald Trump get summarily tossed out everywhere?
There's kind of two parts to that question. One is the premise of the question. I actually think it's an excellent premise. This is something I've been saying for months and months, but no one kind of believed me. And I think that there's real questions about whether it would happen because of Trump's personality. But the safest thing for him to do legally is to pardon all of his family members and cronies and everyone else who he's worried or might know has committed a federal crime. And then the question is, does he pardon himself? Something that most credible, if not all credible legal scholars think a president cannot do. Or does he resign sort of a week early or a month early, a day early, and let Mike Pence become the 46th president of the United States, issue a pardon, and then Pence's term will end the next day or on the 21st. So the I mean, that would be wise legal maneuvering on Trump's part to protect himself. But whether he would do it personality wise or whether he would do it given how bad it might make him look for his claimed 2024 election attempt is another question.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Loyal Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Same caller left another question. This one does not hit on matters that are presently in front of the Supreme Court. But he asked, how long can Trump use the contest the vote issue for personal fundraising? Can he keep using this for personal gain even after he's out of office?
I don't think we answered the previous caller's question exactly. He had asked what would happen to lawsuits involving Trump and any official lawsuit. Simple answer to that question, if Pence takes over, just like if Biden takes over, any official lawsuit would simply have the actor replaced. The new president would become the defendant. Now, that person may change the policies and moot the lawsuits, which I think is what's probably going to happen with the census case and maybe a couple of other cases that involve Trump specifically, one involving whether the Congress can have access to the unredacted Mueller report, another case involving the redirection of border wall funds from the military to building a border wall. New president will come in and change the policies and those cases will become moot. But to answer the specific question, the party would simply be replaced with the new president. In terms of Trump's fundraising, he's going to use that issue forever. I mean, he's going to keep raising money, whether for his legal defense fund, whether buy my book because it's a scam, because I was somehow cheated of my rightful victory, whether he starts a 2024 official campaign and raises money that way. This is a man who lives to be a victim. Right. Or at least to claim to be a victim. And he's going to do it until he is no longer able to have a platform by whatever means that may occur.
We could circle back to some of these President Trump related questions, but I'd like to circle back, move on to another topic that we haven't touched on yet. Let's talk about the pandemic and some of the pandemic related cases. There's quite a few. Ann, would you like to take a crack at some of these?
Sure, absolutely. What I'd like to say first is that you've had both impact in terms of what cases make it up to the Supreme Court, but also how the Supreme Court itself is doing business in the middle of a pandemic. For the first time ever, you have the court actually having live broadcast of its arguments. So for folks who listen to this show, probably might like to listen to some of those live arguments. And we'll see if that's something that changes once we return, or hopefully return, to normal. But I think some of the COVID-19 cases that we've seen come up actually show you the shift in the court that we talked about earlier. So as I think Ben mentioned, there were some early cases where the court denied requests from churches asking for relief from various states or local entities, ordinances restricting how big a group could get together and the circumstances under which they could get together. But very recently in Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn versus Cuomo, the Supreme Court actually enjoined Governor Cuomo from enforcing one of his executive orders that put occupancy limits on religious services in the middle of the pandemic. And it was granted in a per curiam opinion, which just means it's from the court, means there isn't a specific justice who's identified as the author of it. And in it, they basically said, look, this is unfair. We're going to stay this so that you can litigate this in front of the appellate court and, if necessary, come back to the Supreme Court on the merits. But the order here doesn't appear to be neutral. It singles out houses of worship for what it deemed especially harsh treatment. And it said that if you compare it, you know, you have churches who are subject to these very stringent limitations, but there aren't similar limitations on essential businesses like, say, a gym or a campground or something else. And so they said, because it's not neutral, we apply our strictest scrutiny. We look at it, we apply the most difficult level of analysis to it to determine whether it survives. And they said it fails it because it's too broad. There's no evidence that synagogues and churches have contributed to outbreaks, and they could have used something less restrictive to try and achieve the same goals. But again, I think what's interesting here is you see a change in the way that they approached it. Previous requests had been denied. This one got granted. And I think, as you will see, there are other cases working their way up through the system that will present more cases or more opportunities for the court to weigh in on this. Just to give one example, there's Danville Christian Academy versus Bashir, where the court's being asked to temporarily suspend pending appeal a Kentucky governor's executive order forcing the closure of all public and private schools in the state, including religious schools, in light of the pandemic. And they said that violates the Constitution's free exercise clause. So that'll be interesting, because the case they already decided, in part because they said that the churches and synagogues were being treated differently. And the case that they're being asked to consider with the cert petition will then ask them, well, should religious institutions be exempted entirely from these sorts of rules?
And isn't that where we are in California, where the Archbishop just here in San Francisco, I believe, was commenting that they didn't like the idea that attending church services was equated roughly to going to a movie?
I think you've seen a number of these challenges brought throughout the U.S., challenging various ordinances by churches, by religious schools, who've argued that they shouldn't be treated either the same way or that they should be exempted from these rules.
Yeah, this case is more, and these cases are really more about, and I think this is important to recognize, more about religion than the pandemic itself, and are in some ways more of a signal of what impact Justice Coney Barrett is going to have on the way the court approaches religious questions. As Anne said, the question that the court decided the other day involving Brooklyn, and there was actually a related case involving California, is, you know, can you restrict churches more than other types of entities? And the cases coming up are, do churches need special treatment because they're churches, where you can't restrict them at all? They're really special. And the way those cases are decided are going to be a really interesting insight into the effect that Justice Coney Barrett, by all accounts, a very religious person, is going to have on the court's religion jurisprudence. The court's makeup when it comes to religion is really fascinating. In a country that is 70% Protestant, where 70% of Americans who profess to participate in organized religion are some form of Protestant, the court is made up of three people of Jewish faith and five people of Roman Catholic faith. There are no Protestants on the Supreme Court. And that's sort of a fascinating and a strange reality for the court, especially given that Jews and Catholics were historically treated with a tremendous amount of suspicion by the Protestant majority in the United States. So you know, there are a lot of religious folks on the court, and I think the real question is going to be, how special does religion need to be treated in the new 6-3 Supreme Court?
And I think there's another case that was just argued that will give us an interesting view into where the court is headed when we actually get a decision in it. And that's Fulton versus Philadelphia. And that's a case about a Catholic child care agency that had a policy of refusing to place children with gay foster parents. And so this sort of brings us back to the Masterpiece Cake case, which happened in 2018, where the justices had to figure out, okay, if a Colorado baker won't create a custom cake for a same-sex couple because he thought doing so would violate his religious beliefs, you know, what should we do? And the justices ultimately sort of punted on that and said, look, the state administrative agency that ruled against him treated him unfairly. They were too hostile to his religious beliefs. But all of these kind of go to a 1990 Supreme Court decision called Employment Division versus Smith, which held that government actions don't violate the Constitution's free exercise clause as long as they're neutral and apply to everyone. And that's a decision that's come in for a lot of criticism from conservative judges over the years. Nobody likes it. But by the same token, nobody's really sure that they want to replace it because they're not sure what to do with it. And I think the one thing that the argument in this case gave us a sense of is that the court is still pretty reluctant to go ahead and get rid of it. Like I said, this was a case where the city officials had read an article about a complaint against foster care agencies. The question was that the Archdiocese of Philadelphia and CSS follow the Catholic Church's teachings on marriage. And so the city council passed a resolution telling the Department of Human Services to change its contracting practices. And it condemned discrimination, as it put it, that occurs under the guise of religious freedom. In response, CSS and two foster parents sued, and they said, look, DHS should resume referrals to us. They said the city's actions violated the First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause, which protects religious belief and expression, and the Establishment Clause. The District Court and the Third Circuit rejected those arguments, but the Supreme Court took it. And I think once they took it, they weren't quite sure what to do with it. And I think that's sort of the lesson, is that they're really difficult, complicated questions, and the court really isn't sure just how far it wants to go. Ben, I don't know if you have a different...
I think that this is going to be one of the cases where Justice Coney Barrett is going to be different and is going to have a different result than you would have with Justice Ginsburg. The real fundamental question here is, do rules that say you can't discriminate against people on the basis of race, of course, but here we're talking about sexual orientation. Does that apply to other private businesses when those businesses have a religious part to how they operate? And we saw this come up with a Hobby Lobby case. You may remember a case involving the birth control mandate for a company called Hobby Lobby. That's a private company that has an expressed religious view. And there the Supreme Court said, look, you're a private company. You don't want to cover birth control because it's against your religion. That's your religious liberty. In the Cake case that Anne, you know, just mentioned, the court said, well, you know, this is getting pretty close because this is just a regular business on the street, and we don't want businesses discriminating certainly on the basis of race. We don't want a cake company to say, hey, we're not going to make you a cake because you're black or doing an interracial marriage. And so we're going to send this back, and hopefully the parties can kind of come up with a better solution themselves, is really what the court said. And then here we have a situation where you've got a religious organization. There's no question about that. And this organization is, it's Catholic. It does foster care. And they say, look, it is completely against our faith to put a child in a situation where they are exposed to people who are doing something that we believe is a sin. And therefore, we don't think that we should be compelled to do this. And I think the Supreme Court is likely to agree with the foster care agency in this case. I don't know how they're going to work through the doctrinal issues that Anne mentioned, but I think after listening to the argument and kind of seeing the alignment and the views of the justices, I think they're going to say, look, you've got a religious foster care company or agency. You know, we're not going to force you to put kids in situations that you think are genuinely dangerous.
Let me take us in a little bit of a different direction. Obamacare is back to the Supreme Court. It was there many years ago, and it's back again. So why doesn't somebody take us through what was there before, what's there now, and what we anticipate happening?
Yeah, this is the third time Obamacare has now come before the Supreme Court. You know, it's come up in lots of different forms, and it's survived every time. And I'll give you a little tip. It's going to survive again. This was a big – the Democrats made a very big deal about this during the confirmation of Justice Coney Barrett, where they said, you know, oh, Trump's trying to put this person in who's going to throw out Obamacare. And, you know, look, it's a perfectly fair concern. But I think that the reality of the nuances of the case – and again, remember what I said earlier about the differences between conservative politics and conservative judicial approaches. They really are different. I think those two factors are going to come together and lead the court to once again uphold Obamacare. Now, the case is basically, you may remember Obamacare 2010, Affordable Care Act, lets you go to these exchanges online. You can pick your health insurance. You can't lose your insurance if you've got a pre-existing condition. Big success for the Obama administration. One of the key issues of contention was the law contained something called an individual mandate. This required every American to purchase health insurance if you didn't get it through a job. And if you didn't, there was a penalty on your taxes. It wasn't a huge penalty, or it might be a huge penalty, but there was a penalty of some kind depending on your situation. That was the source of the first challenge, the first really big challenge to Obamacare. Can Congress go in and tell all Americans, hey, you have to buy health insurance? You have to, as Justice Scalia said, can they say, do you have to buy broccoli? You have to eat broccoli every day. But the court ultimately said, John Roberts essentially ultimately saved Obamacare and said, look, this isn't really the government going in and telling you what to do. This is just saying you can do this or not, but if you don't do this, there's a tax associated with it. And so that's a little bit of a different issue. And that was enough to get a 5-4 majority to uphold Obamacare. Now, fast forward to 2017, Trump has taken office. Congress passes the big tax law that year, which included a provision taking away this tax penalty. There's no tax penalty anymore. So all of a sudden, some conservative states got together and they said, whoa, you had this other case where you said the taxes were the reason that this law could survive because it's only a tax. Well, now there isn't even a tax. The whole law has to be thrown out. This is one of those cases that is intellectually extremely weak. It is not a very sound legal position. It's not a very well-reasoned intellectual position, but it's being done for political reasons. There are a huge amount of sort of visceral opposition from voters in conservative states to what they understand to be Obamacare. Now, when you ask them if they actually like the Affordable Care Act, they say yes, but they really hate Obamacare, not recognizing it's the same thing. However, the case that was brought by a number of states said, hey, look, you got rid of this tax, this individual mandate. Well, the whole law has to go. The real legal question is about whether you can separate those two things. Can Congress say, hey, there's no longer going to be this penalty if you don't buy insurance without the rest of the law kind of being lost? I think the answer is going to be clearly yes, that Congress was the one who put the tax in the first place. Congress got rid of it. Why not? Well within Congress's authority. So I think that Obamacare is probably going to survive. Some justices may write to say they don't think Obamacare should exist at all for one reason or other, but I think it's gonna live to see another day. Especially during the pandemic. I mean, the appearances of all of this during the pandemic are almost vile, really. I mean, they really are kind of revolting. And you know, how many people, millions of people would lose health insurance when they might die from coronavirus? Come on.
As we're starting to get a little close to the end of the hour, I'd like to cover a couple of other things. First, I'd like to turn it to Anne and ask, what's in the hopper with regard to criminal law?
Sure. Well, there's some really interesting cases coming up. And I think one of the broader questions that kind of transcends any individual case is whether some of the rethinking that's occurred in light of George Floyd's death and some of the increasing publicity about how law enforcement operates, whether that's actually going to shift the way that judges approach some of these cases. And so I wanted to take as an example, Taylor versus Riojas, which was a recent decision from the Supreme Court. And this was a case brought by an inmate who had to spend 6 days naked in a cell that was full of feces from previous occupants and overflowing sewage. And the Court of Appeal, after Taylor said, look, that violates the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment, which I think most of us would probably agree with. That sounds pretty horrible. But the Fifth Circuit invoked something called qualified immunity. And the idea of qualified immunity is that officials shouldn't be held liable unless there's a clearly established violation of law. But the problem is there's an earlier Supreme Court decision that said you don't have to decide that there's a violation as long as you conclude that it's not clearly established. And as a result, you haven't, oftentimes things aren't identified as a violation. And so here the Fifth Circuit said, look, this isn't really, an officer might not have known that it was not, that it was a constitutional violation to make somebody sleep for 6 days in a cold cell that's full of sewage and human excrement. And the Supreme Court reversed. Interestingly, it was a per curiam decision, like we talked about before. That's an issue, that's a decision by the Supreme Court. And Justice Thomas dissented without actually explaining why. But I think one of the interesting things that you see in some of the appellate courts is you are seeing an increasing pushback on qualified immunity and a willingness to sort of question whether what had become this kind of game of semantics about, okay, you know, yes, you got hit, but they hit you with a closed fist on the right side of your body instead of on the left side of your body. And so the official is protected because he gets qualified immunity. I think you're seeing some uncomfortable, some discomfort with applying that and some willingness to think about whether qualified immunity needs to be pulled back somewhat.
And maybe at some point, I'm sorry, Ben, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think that feeling, just very briefly, I think that feeling has grown and attention has been focused on qualified immunity arising out of the sort of race-related protests earlier this summer. That really drew a lot of attention to situations where a police officer may do something, shoot somebody because they think that they're under some sort of pressure, and sort of folks look at the situation or the video and they say, gosh, how could it be legal to do that? Like kick down someone's door and have the wrong house and shoot them. And you know, the courts have said, look, there wasn't, for the most part, there wasn't a clearly established case or situation that showed that you can't do this ever, and therefore there's not going to be any liability. And people are really pushing back against that now, I think, as attention has been added to it. And look at this case Ann is talking about. What a horrible situation. You're going to throw someone in a feces-covered cell for 6 days or something. You can't do that. Everyone knows you can't do that. And here the Supreme Court said, yeah, you can't do that. Although Justice Thomas apparently would be fine if they did that. So, but he didn't tell us why.
So one more criminal case, if I could very quickly, that also raised an interesting issue is Van Buren versus United States, which deals with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And that was just a question about whether a police officer in Georgia, who was under law, he could search computerized records about license plates for law enforcement purposes, but he actually did it for private purposes at the request of an informant who said he'd pay him to run the search. And he was subsequently convicted. And this is a statute that's not entirely clear. But what is clear is that you've seen federal prosecutors apply it in ways that have perhaps exceeded the statutory language, or at least that's certainly the impression that the Supreme Court gave at oral argument. And I think it was interesting because you actually had one of the justices in oral argument, Justice Gorsuch, saying, look, isn't this part of a long line of cases recently where we've had to push back because you have read a statute, you've tried to expand federal criminal jurisdiction in pretty significant and contestable ways that we've then had to reject. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen in that decision. We'll expect a decision by the end of the term. But what's clear is that you get some real concern about prosecutorial overreach.
And I think it's about privacy at a fundamental level. This is something that isn't, you know, many of the social legal conflicts that arise out of the Constitution have to do with privacy in one sense or another. Do you have a right of privacy that allows you to obtain an abortion? Do you have a right of privacy that allows you to obtain contraception? And this is a situation where the, even though it's statutory in nature, where the underlying question is, gosh, can somebody pay a police officer to search through a database for you, for them, and get all kinds of private confidential information about you and kind of just hand that over? And that's not a crime under the computer laws. I think there might be some discomfort with that. They might want to say, hey, this might be a crime.
Well, there certainly was. I think when you look at, if you listen to the argument, there were certainly some justices who were like, look, the last thing we want to do is do anything that seems like we're endorsing this kind of conduct. But one of the points that also was raised was like, look, aren't there other laws, state and federal, that can deal with this and that are a better and more appropriate way of doing it than something like this?
So let's move on to another topic if we can real quick, and let's spend about few minutes, maybe 2 minutes tops. Ben, do you want to take us through anything that's interesting happening in the way of human rights?
Keep it down to about 90 seconds.
Sure, 90 seconds. So there's a case that was just argued last week, I want to say, although the weeks are flowing together in the pandemic, involving whether a statute under the United States can be used to sue Nestle and Cargill for allegedly buying cocoa and selling farm equipment to plantations in Africa that use child slavery. And so there's a big question of whether, well, one, you know, can you sue in the United States companies that did something wrong allegedly somewhere else? And then two, can you sue companies at all? Because the law this arises from is a law that is one of the oldest laws in the United States. It's called the Alien Tort Statute or the Alien Tort Claims Act. And this allows people who aren't Americans to sue in American courts for violations of the laws of nations, piracy, forced servitude, beyond what was at the time lawful slavery. And so that's the real question. And I think that the Supreme Court was wrestling with this one as well. The Supreme Court didn't want to seem to say, hey, look, corporations get a free pass, even though at the time the statute was enacted, there weren't very many corporations doing big international law violations.
And interestingly, at the argument, Justice Kagan drew a historical analogy, and she pointed out that actually after the transatlantic slave trade was abolished, there's a long history of imposing liability on ships as opposed to individuals. And so that this would support a finding that the suit against Nestle and Cargill could go forward. One other interesting point is one brief made the point of, well, look, they didn't go after companies that supported the Nazi regime, so you shouldn't do so here, which, while true, may not be the most effective point to make on your behalf.
It's a bad look in a brief, guys.
Well, we're essentially out of time, and I want to give each of you about a minute for any last thoughts that you have, and we really can't run over.
Go ahead, Anne.
Sure, I'll just go very quickly. I think what will be interesting in the rest of the term is to see what cases the court chooses to take to fill the rest of the term. And who decides them? I mean, there is a question about whether President-elect Biden is going to get a chance to nominate someone to the Supreme Court, and it'll be very interesting to see what happens. That, I think, is going to turn a lot on the results of the runoff elections in January, because who can get confirmed under a Senate controlled by McConnell is very, very different than a Senate where the new vice president can actually cast a deciding vote.
And the takeaway that I would give is, you know, this is now definitely a conservative Supreme Court 6-3, but conservative judicial approaches are different from conservative political approaches. And you're going to see more and more divergence, I think, between the kind of Trumpian populism, that form of conservatism, and kind of judicial conservatism that originalism and textualism, terms you may have heard, that the Supreme Court justices stand for.
Josh, you have a little bit of time. Do you want to take 30 seconds or so for any closing remarks you have?
I actually don't. I think our panelists have taught us all something fascinating about what's happening, and I look forward to seeing what's going to happen with the Supreme Court and what changes are going to come down from the new justice.
You know, I think that's true for me as well. We've both learned a lot. And there's a lot more material we had set aside that we didn't get to, so we're going to have to resume this and make this a regular feature. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights at KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been looking down the pipeline of cases pending at the Supreme Court. Our guests tonight have been, from King & Spalding, Certified Appellate Law Specialist, Ann Voights, and Chairman of the California Appellate Law Group, Ben Foyer. My co-host tonight, Josh Borger. Our show tonight's been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. Your Legal Rights returns next week at our new time of 6 o'clock as we broach the world of artificial intelligence and the law that surrounds it. Once again, our thanks to Ben Foyer and Ann Voights and to Josh Boyer for joining us tonight. And especially our thanks to all of you for joining us. And at the controls, Debbie Kennedy. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.